She broke off, lower lip caught between her teeth.
"Yeah, I see," he said.
And did. He took her by the arm and steered her down the hall to the kitchen, where he plunked her in a chair at the battered old table.
"I'll put the kettle on."
"I don't like tea," she protested.
"You need tea," Roger said firmly,
and lit the gas with a fiery whoosh. He turned to the cupboard and took down cups and saucers and, as an afterthought, the bottle of whiskey from the top shelf. "And I really don't like whiskey," Brianna said, eyeing it. She started to push herself away from the table, but Roger stopped her with a hand on her arm.
"I like whiskey," he said, "but I hate to drink alone. You'll keep me company, eh?"
He smiled at her, willing her to smile back. At last she did, grudgingly, and relaxed in her seat. He sat down opposite her and filled his cup halfway with the pungent amber liquid. He breathed in the fumes with pleasure and sipped slowly, letting the fine, strong stuff roll down his throat.
"Ah," he breathed, "Glenmorangie. Sure you won't join me? A wee splash in your tea, maybe?"
She shook her head silently, but when the kettle began to whistle, she got up to take it off the fire and pour the hot water into the waiting pot. Roger got up and came behind her, slipping his arms around her waist.
"There's nothing to be ashamed of," he said softly. "You've a right to know, if you can. Jamie Fraser was your father, after all."
"But he wasn't. Not really." Her head was bent. He could see the neat wall of a cowlick at her crown, an echo of the one in the centre of her forehead that lifted her hair in a soft wave off her face. "I had a father," she said, sounding a little choked. "Daddy, Frank Randall, he was my father, and I loved him. It doesn't seem right to go looking for something else, like he wasn't enough, like..."
"That's not it, then, and you knew it."
He turned her round and lifted her chin with a finger.
"Has nothing to do with Frank Randall or how you feel about him, I. He was your father, and there's not a thing will ever change that. But it's natural to be curious, to want to know."
"Did you ever want to know?" Her hand came up and brushed his away, but she clung to his fingers, holding on. He took a deep breath, finding comfort in the whiskey.
"Yeah. Yes, I did. You need to, I think."
His fingers tightened around hers, drawing her toward the table.
"Come, sit down. I'll tell you."
He knew what missing a father felt like, especially an unknown father. For a time, just after he'd started school, he'd pored obsessively over his father's medals, carried the little velvet case about in his pocket, boasted to his friends about his father's heroism.
"Told stories about him, all made up," he said, looking down into the aromatic depths of his teacup. "Got bashed for being a nuisance. Got smacked at school for lying."
He looked up at her and smiled, a little painfully.
"I had to make him real, see?"
She nodded, eyes dark with understanding. He took another deep gulp of the whiskey, not bothering to savour it.
"Luckily, Dad, the Reverend, he seemed to know the trouble. He began to tell me stories about my father, the real ones. Nothing special, nothing heroic. He was a hero, all right. Jerry Mackenzie, got shot down and all. But the stories Dad told were all about what he was like as a kid. How he made a Martin house but made the hole too big and a cuckoo got in. What he liked to eat when he'd come here on holiday and they'd go into town for a treat. How he filled his pockets with winkles off the rocks and forgot about them and ruined his trousers with the stink."
He broke off and smiled at her, his throat still tight at the memory.
"He made my father real to me, and I missed him more than ever, because then I knew a bit about what I was missing. But I had to know."
"Some people would say you can't miss what you never had, that it's better not to know at all." Brianna lifted her cup, blue eyes steady over the rim.
"Some people are fools. Or cowards."
He poured another tot of whiskey into his cup, tilted the bottle toward her with a lifted brow. She held out her cup without comment, and he splashed whiskey into it. She drank from it and set it down.
"What about your mother?" she asked.
"I had a few real memories of her. I was nearly 5 when she died. And there are the boxes in the garage."
He tilted his head toward the window.
"All her things, her letters. It's like Dad said, everybody needs a history. Mine was out there. I knew if I ever needed to, I could find out more."
He studied her for a long moment.
"You miss her a lot," he said. "Claire."
She glanced at him, nodded briefly, and drank, then held out her empty cup for more.
I was afraid to look," she said, eyes fixed on the stream of whiskey. "It's not just him, it's her too. I mean, I know his stories. Jamie Fraser's. She's told me a lot about him.
A lot more than I'll ever find in historical records," she added, with a feeble attempt at a smile.
She took a deep breath.
"But Mama, at first I tried to pretend she was only gone, like on a trip. But when I couldn't do that anymore, I tried to believe she was dead."
Her nose was running from emotion, whiskey, or the heat of the tea. Roger reached for the tea towel hanging by the stove and shoved it across the table to her.
"She isn't, though."
She picked up the towel and wiped angrily at her nose. "That's the trouble. I have to miss her all the time and to know that I'll never see her again, but she isn't even dead. How can I mourn for her when I think, when I hope, she's happy where she is, when I made her go?"
She gulped the rest of her cup, choked slightly, and got her breath.
She fixed Roger with a dark blue glare as though he were to blame for the situation.
"So I want to find out, all right? I want to find her. Find them. See if she's all right. But I keep thinking maybe I don't want to find out, because what if I find out she's not all right? What if I find out something horrible? What if I find out she's dead? Or he is? Well, that wouldn't matter so much, maybe, because he already is dead anyway. Or he was, or... But I have to. I know I have to."
She banged her cup down on the table in front of him. "More." He opened his mouth to say that she'd had a good bit more than she needed already, but a glance at her face changed his mind. He shut his mouth and poured. She didn't wait for him to add tea, but raised the cup to her mouth and took a large swallow and another. She coughed, sputtered, and set the cup down, eyes watering.
"So I'm looking. Or I was. When I saw Daddy's books and his handwriting, though, it all seemed wrong then. Do you think I'm wrong?" she asked, peering woefully at him through tear-clogged lashes.
"No, Hen," he said gently. "It's not wrong. You're right, you've got to know. I'll help you."
He stood up and, taking her under the arms, hoisted her to her feet.
"But right now, I think you should maybe have a bit of a lie-down,
He got her up the stairs and halfway down the hall, when she suddenly broke free and darted into the bathroom. He leaned against the wall outside, waiting patiently until she staggered out again, her face the colour of the aged plaster above the wainscoting.
"Waste of Glenmorangie, that," he said, taking her by the shoulders and steering her into the bedroom. "If I'd known I was dealing with a sot, I'd have given you the cheap stuff."
She collapsed on the bed and allowed him to take off her shoes and socks. She rolled onto her stomach, Uncle Angus cradled in the crook of her arm.
"I told you I didn't like tea," she mumbled,
and was asleep in seconds. Roger worked for an hour or two by himself, sorting books and tying cartons. It was a quiet, dark afternoon, with no sound but a soft patter of rain and the occasional whoosh of a car's tyres on the street outside. When the light began to fail, he turned on the lamps and went down the hall to the kitchen to wash the book grime from his hands. A huge pot of milky, cocker-leaky soup was burbling on the back of the cooker. What had Fiona said to do about that? Turn it up? Turn it off? Throw things into it? He peered dubiously into the pot and decided to leave well enough alone. He tidied up the remains of their impromptu tea, rinsed the cups and dried them, hung them carefully from their hooks in the cupboard. They were remnants of the old willow pattern set the Reverend had had for as long as Roger could remember. The blue and white Chinese trees and pagodas, augmented by odd bits of ill-assorted crockery acquired from jumble sales. Fiona would have all new, of course. She'd forced them to look at magazine pictures of china and crystal and flatware. Brianna had made suitable admiring noises. Roger's eyes had gone glassy from boredom. He supposed the old stuff would all end up at the jumble sale. At least it might still be useful to someone. On impulse, he took down the two cups he'd washed, wrapped them in a clean tea towel, and took them to the study where he'd tucked them into the box he'd set aside for himself. He felt thoroughly foolish, but at the same time, somewhat better. He looked around the echoing study, quite bare now save for the single sheet of paper on the cork-lined wall. "So, your home's gone for good." Well, he'd left home some time ago, hadn't he? Yeah, it bothered him. A lot more than he'd let on to Brianna, in fact. That was why it had taken so bloody long to finish clearing out the manse, if he was honest about it. True, it was a monster task. True, he had his own job to do at Oxford. And true, the thousands of books had had to be sorted with care. But he could have done it faster, if he'd wanted. With the house standing vacant, he might never have got the job finished. But with the impetus of Fiona behind and the lure of Brianna before, he smiled at the thought of the two of them, little dark curly-headed wren and tall fire-haired Viking. Likely it took women to get men to do anything much. Time to finish up, though. With a sense of sombre ceremony, he unpinned the corners of the yellowed sheet of paper and took it down from the cork. It was his family tree, a genealogical chart made out in the Reverend's neat, round hand. Mackenzies and more Mackenzies, generations of them. He'd thought lately of taking back the name permanently, not just for the singing. After all, with Dad gone, he didn't mean to come back much more to Inverness, where folk would know him as Wakefield. That had been the point of the genealogy, after all, that Roger shouldn't forget who he was. Dad had known a few individual stories, but no more than the names for most of the people on the list. And he hadn't known even that for the most important one, the woman whose green eyes Roger saw each morning in the mirror. She was nowhere on this list, for good reason. Roger's finger stopped near the top of the chart. There he was, the changeling, William Buccleuch Mackenzie, given to foster parents to raise the illegitimate offspring of the war chieftain of Clan Mackenzie and of a witch condemned to burning, Dougal Mackenzie and the witch Gilles Duncan. Not a witch at all, of course, but something just as dangerous. He had her eyes, or so Claire said. Had he inherited something more from her as well? Was the terrifying ability to travel through the stones passed down unsuspected through generations of respectable boatwrights and herdsmen? He thought of it each time he saw the chart now, and for that reason tried not to look. He appreciated Brianna's ambivalence. He understood all too well the razor's edge between fear and curiosity, the pull between the need to know and the fear of finding out. Well, he could help Brianna find out. And for himself? Roger slipped the chart into a folder and put it in the box. He closed the top of the carton and added an X of sticky tape across the flap for good measure. "That's that, then," he said aloud, and left the empty room. He stopped at the head of the stairs, taken by surprise. Brianna had been bathing, braving the ancient geyser with its cracked enamel and rumbling flame. Now she stepped into the hall, wearing nothing but a towel. She turned down the hall, not seeing him. Roger stood very still, listening to the thud of his heart, feeling his palm slick on the polished banister. She was modestly covered. He had seen more of her in the halters and shorts she had worn in the summer. It was the fragility of her covering that roused him, the knowledge that he could undress her with one quick tug. That, and the knowledge that they were quite alone in the house. Dynamite. He took a step after her and stopped. She had heard him. She stopped too. But it was a long moment before she turned around. Her feet were bare, high-arched and long-toed. The slender curves of her wet footprints were dark on the worn runner that covered the floor of the hallway. She didn't say anything, just looked at him straight on, her eyes dark and slanting. She stood against the tall window at the end of the hall, her swaddled figure black against the pale grey light of the rainy day outside. If he should touch her, he knew how she would feel. Her skin would be still hot from the bath, damp in the crevices of knee and thigh and elbow. He could smell her, the minglings of shampoo and soap and powder, the smell of her flesh masked by the ghosts of flowers. Her footprints on the runner stretched before him, a fragile chain of footsteps linking them. He kicked off his sandals and planted a bare foot on one of the prints she had left. It was cool on his skin. There were drops of water on her shoulders, matching the droplets on the windowpane behind her, as though she had stepped through it, out of the rain. She lifted her head as he came toward her, and with a shake, let the towel wrapped round her head fall off. The bronze snakes of her hair fell gleaming, brushed his cheek with wet. Not a gorgon's beauty, but a water spirit's, changing shape from serpent-maned horse to magic woman. "Kelpie," he whispered against the flushed curve of her cheek. "You look like you've come straight out of a Highland burn." She put her arms around his neck, let go of the towel. Only the pressure of their bodies held it between them. Her back was bare. Cold air from the window raised the hair on his forearm, even as her skin warmed his palm. He wanted at once to pull the towel about her, shelter her, cover her from the cold. At the same time, to strip both her and himself, take her heat to himself, and give her his own, right there, in the damp and draughty hallway. "Steam," he whispered. "God, you're steaming." Her mouth curved against his. "That makes two of us. And you haven't had a bath." "Roger." Her hand was on the back of his neck, fingers cool. She opened her mouth to say something more. But he kissed her, feeling hot damp seep through the fabric of his shirt. Her breasts rose against him, and her mouth opened under his. The muffling terry cloth hid the outlines of her breasts from his hands, but not his imagination. He could see them in his mind's eye, round and smooth, with that faint, enchanting wobble of full flesh. His hand drifted lower, grasping the swell of bare buttock. She shied, lost her balance, and the two of them collapsed awkwardly, grappling with each other in an effort to stay upright. Roger's knees hit the floor, and he dragged her down with him. She tilted and sprawled, landing laughing on her back. "Hey!" She grabbed for her towel, then abandoned it as he lunged over her, kissing her again. He'd been right about her breasts. The one under his hand was bare now, full and soft, the nipple hard in the center of his palm. Dynamite. And the fuse was lit. His other hand rested at the top of her thigh under the towel, close enough that he could feel the damp curls brush his finger. God, what color was it? Deep auburn, as he'd imagined. Copper and bronze, like the hair of her head. Despite himself, his hand slid farther, dying to cup the soft, slippery fullness he could sense so close. With an effort that made him dizzy, he stopped. Her hand was on his arm, pulling him back down. "Please," she whispered. "Please. I want you to." He felt hollow as a bell. His heartbeat echoed in head and chest and painfully hard between his legs. He closed his eyes, breathing, pressing his hands against the rough fibre of the rug, trying to erase the feel of her skin, lest he grab at her again.
"No," he said, and his voice sounded queer, hoarse to his own ear. "No, not here. Not like this."
She was sitting up, rising out of the dark blue towel that puddled around her hips, like a mermaid from the waves. She had cooled. Her flesh was pale as marble in the grey light, but goosebumps stippled the smoothness of arms and breasts and shoulders. He touched her, rough skin and smooth, and drew his fingers over her lips, her broad mouth. The taste of her was still on his lips, clean skin and toothpaste, and a sweet, soft tongue.
"Better," he whispered. "I want it to be better. The first time."
They knelt staring at each other, the air between them crackling with unsaid things. The fuse was still burning, but a slow match now. Roger felt rooted to the spot. Perhaps it was the Gorgon, after all. Then the smell of scorching milk rose up the stair and both of them started up at once. "Something's burning," Brianna said, and made a dart toward the stair, her towel clumsily back in place. He caught her by the arm as she passed by. She was cold to the touch, chilled by the draughty hallway.
"I'll do it," he said. "You go and get dressed."
She shot him a quick blue glance and turned, disappearing into the spare bedroom. The door clicked shut behind her, and he dashed down the hall, clattering down the stair toward the smell of disaster, feeling his palm burn where he had touched her. Downstairs, Roger dealt with the spilled and scalded soup, berating himself. Where did he get off lunging at her like a crazed salmon en route to the spawning grounds, ripping off her towel and grappling her to the floor? Christ! She must think him next door to a rapist. At the same time, the hot feeling that suffused his chest wasn't due either to shame or to heat from the cooker. It was the latent heat from her skin, still warming him.
"I want you to," she'd said,
and she'd meant it. He was familiar enough with the language of the body to know desire and surrender when he touched them. But what he'd felt in that brief moment when her body came alive to his went a great deal farther. The universe had shifted with a small, decisive click. He could still hear its echo in his bones. He wanted her. He wanted all of her. Not just bed, not just body. Everything, always. Suddenly, the biblical injunction, one flesh, seemed something immediate and very real. They'd nearly been just that on the floor of the hallway, and stopping as he had made him feel suddenly and peculiarly vulnerable. He wasn't a whole person any longer, but only half of something not yet made. He dumped the ruined remains of the soup into the sink. No matter, they'd have supper at the pub. Best to get out of the house and away from temptation. Supper, casual chat, and maybe a walk by the river. She'd wanted to go to the Christmas Eve services. After that, he would ask her, make it formal. She would say yes, he knew. And then? Why, then they would come home, to a house dark and private, with themselves alone, on a night of sacrament and secret, with love newly come into the world. And he would lift her in his arms and carry her upstairs on a night when virginity's sacrifice was no loss of purity, but rather the birth of everlasting joy. Roger switched out the light and left the kitchen. Behind him, forgotten, the gas flame burned blue and yellow in the dark, ardent and steady as the fires of love. Chapter 18. unseemly lust. The Reverend Wakefield had been a kindly and ecumenical man, tolerant of all shades of religious opinion, and willing to entertain doctrines his flock would have found outrageous, if not downright blasphemous. Still, a lifetime of exposure to the stern face of Scottish Presbyterianism and its abiding suspicion of anything Romish had left Roger with a certain residual uneasiness upon entering a Catholic church, as though he might be seized at the door and forcibly baptized by outlandishly dressed minions of the True Cross. No such violence offered as he followed Brianna into the small stone building. There was a boy in a long white robe visible at the far end of the nave, but he was peaceably engaged in lighting two pairs of tall white candles that decorated the altar. A faint, unfamiliar scent hung in the air. Roger inhaled, trying to be unobtrusive about it. Incense? Beside him, Brianna stopped, rummaging in her purse. She took out a small circle of black lacy stuff and bobby-pinned it to the top of her head.
"What's that?" he asked.
"I don't know what you call it," she said. "It's what you wear in church if you don't want to wear a hat or a veil. You don't really have to do it any more, but I grew up doing it. It used to be that women couldn't go into a Catholic church with their heads uncovered, you know."
"No, I didn't," he said, interested. "Why not?"
"St. Paul, probably," she said, whipping a comb from her purse to tidy the ends of her hair. "He thought women ought to keep their hair covered all the time, so as not to be objects of unseemly lust. Cranky old crab," she added, stuffing the comb back into the purse. "Mama always said he was afraid of women. Thought they were dangerous," she said with a wide grin.
"They are."
Impulsively he leaned forward and kissed her, ignoring the stares of the people nearby. She looked surprised, but then rocked forward on her toes and kissed him back, soft and quick. Roger heard a faint of disapproval somewhere nearby, but paid no attention.
"In Kirk, and on Christmas Eve too," came a hoarse whisper from behind. "Well, it's no the Kirk exactly, Annie, it's only the vestibule, aye? And him the minister's lad and all. Well, you ken the saying, Annie. As the cobbler's bairns go barefoot. I dare say it's all the same with your preacher's lad that's gone to the deal. Come along in now."
The voices receded into the church, to the prim tap of Cuban heels, and a man's softer shuffle accompanying. Brianna pulled back a little and looked up at him, mouth quivering with laughter. "Have you gone to the devil?" He smiled down at her and touched her glowing face. She wore her grandmother's necklace in honour of Christmas, and her skin reflected the lustre of the freshwater pearls.
"If the devil will have me."
Before she could answer, they were interrupted by a gust of foggy air as the church door opened.
"Mr. Wakefield, is it yourself?"
He turned to meet two pairs of bright inquisitive eyes beaming up at him. A pair of elderly women, each about 4 foot 6, stood arm in arm in their winter coats, grey hair puffed out under small felt hats, looking like a matched set of doorstops.
"Mrs. McCurdo, Mrs. Hayes, happy Christmas to you."
He nodded to them, smiling. Mrs. McMurdo lived 2 doors down from the manse and walked to church every Sunday with her friend, Mrs. Hayes. Roger had known them all his life.
"Come over to Rome, then, have you, Mr. Wakefield?"
Chrissy McMurdo asked. Jessie Hayes giggled at her friend's wit, the red cherries bouncing on her hat.
"Maybe not just yet a while," Roger said, still smiling. "I'm only seeing a friend to the services, aye? You'll know Miss Randall."
He brought Brianna forward and made the introductions, grinning inwardly as the two little old ladies looked her over with a frankly avid curiosity. To Mrs. McMurdo and Mrs. Hayes, his presence here was as overt a declaration of his intentions as if he'd taken out a full-page ad in the evening newspaper. Too bad Brianna was unaware of it. Or was she? She glanced at him with a half-hidden smile, and he felt the pressure of her fingers on his arm, just for a moment.
"Oh, there's the wee laddie coming wi' the censer," cried Mrs. Hayes, spotting another white-robed boy emerging from the sanctuary. "Best get in quick, Chrissy, or we'll never have a seat. "Such a pleasure to meet you, my dear,"
Mrs. McMurdo told Brianna, head tilted back so far that her hat was in danger of falling off.
"My, such a bonny tall lass."
She glanced at Roger, twinkling.
"Lucky to have found a lad to match you, eh? Chrissy!" "Just coming, Jessie, just coming. Dinner fash, there's time."
Straightening her hat, trimmed with a small bunch of grouse's feathers, Mrs. McMurdo turned in leisurely fashion to join her friend. The bell above them began to clang again, and Roger took Brianna's arm. Just in front of them, he saw Jessie Hayes glance back, eyes bright with speculation, her smile half sly with knowing. Brianna dipped her fingers in a small stone basin set in the wall by the door and crossed herself. Roger found the gesture suddenly and oddly familiar, despite its Romanness. Years ago, hill-walking with the Reverend, they'd come upon a saint's pool hidden in a grove. There was a flat stone standing on end beside the tiny spring, the remnants of carving on it worn nearly to smoothness, no more than the shadow of a human figure. A sense of mystery hung about the small, dark pool. He and the Reverend had stood there for some time, not speaking. Then the Reverend had bent, scooped up a handful of water, and poured it out at the foot of the stone in silent ceremony, scooped up another, and splashed it over his face. Only then had they knelt by the spring to drink the cold, sweet water. Above the Reverend's bowed back, Roger had seen the tattered knots of fabric tied to tree branches above the spring. Pledges, reminders of prayer left by whoever still visited the ancient shrine. For how many thousands of years had men thus blessed themselves with water before seeking their heart's desire? Roger dabbled his fingers in the water and awkwardly touched both head and heart with something that might have been a prayer. They found seats in the east transept, crowded shoulder to shoulder with a murmuring family busily engaged in settling belongings and sleepy children, passing coats and handbags and baby bottles to and fro, while a small wheezy organ played "O Little Town of Bethlehem" somewhere just out of sight. Then the music stopped. There was a silence of expectation, and then it burst out once more in a loud rendition of "O Come, All Ye Faithful." Roger rose with the congregation as the procession came down the centre aisle. There were several of the white-robed acolytes, one with a swinging censer that sent puffs of fragrant smoke into the crowd. Another bore a book, and a third a tall crucifix, the gruesome figure on it blatant, daubed with red paint, whose bloody echoes shimmered in the priest's vestment of gold and crimson. Despite himself, Roger felt a slight sense of shocked distaste. The mixture of barbaric pageantry and the undulations of sung Latin were quite foreign to what he subconsciously felt was proper in church. Still, as the Mass went on, things seemed more normal. There were Bible readings, quite familiar, and then the accustomed descent into the vaguely pleasant boredom of a sermon, in which the inevitable Christmas annunciations of peace, goodwill, and love rose to the surface of his mind, tranquil as white lilies floating on a pond of words. By the time the congregation rose again, Roger had lost all sense of strangeness. Surrounded by a warm, familiar church fug composed of floor polish, damp wool, naphtha fumes, and a faint whiff of the whiskey with which some worshippers had fortified themselves for the long service, he scarcely noticed the sweet, musky scent of frankincense. Breathing deeply, he thought he caught the hint of fresh grass from Brianna's hair. It shone in the dim light of the transept, thick and soft against the dark violet of her jumper. Its copper sparks muted by the dimness, it was the deep, rufous colour of a red deer's pelt, and it gave him the same sense of helpless yearning he had felt when surprised by a deer on a highland path. The strong urge to touch it, stroke the wild thing, and keep it somehow with him, coupled with the sure knowledge that a finger's move would send it flying. Whatever one thought of St. Paul, he thought, the man had known what he was on about with respect to women's hair.
Unseemly lust, was it? He had a sudden memory of the bare hallway and the steam rising from Brianna's body, the wet snakes of her hair cold on his skin. He looked away, trying to concentrate on the goings-on at the altar, where the priest was raising a large flat disc of bread, while a small boy madly shook a chime of bells. He watched her when she went up to take communion, and became aware with a slight start that he was praying wordlessly. He relaxed just a bit when he realized the content of his prayer. It wasn't the ignoble, "Let me have her," he might have expected. It was the more humble and acceptable, he hoped. "Let me be worthy of her. Let me love her rightly. Let me take care of her." He nodded toward the altar, then caught the curious eye of the man next to him and straightened up, clearing his throat, embarrassed as though he had been surprised in private conversation. She came back, eyes wide open and fixed on something deep inside, a small dreaming smile on her wide, sweet mouth. She knelt, and he beside her. She had a tender look at the moment, but it wasn't a gentle face. Straight nosed and severe, with thick red brows, redeemed from heaviness only by the grace of their arch. The cleanness of jaw and cheek might have been cut from white marble. It was the mouth that could change in a moment, from soft generosity to the mouth of a medieval abbess, lips sealed in cool stone celibacy. The thick Glaswegian voice beside him, bawling, "We three kings," brought him to with a start, in time to see the priest sweep down the aisle, surrounded by his acolytes, in clouds of triumphant smoke. "We three kings of Orient are," Brianna sang quietly as they made their way down River Walk, "going to smoke a rubber cigar. It was loaded and exploded." "You did turn out the gas, didn't you?"
"Yes," he assured her. "Not to worry. Between the cooker and the bathroom geezer, if the manse hasn't gone up in flames yet, it must be proof of divine protection."
She laughed.
"Do Presbyterians believe in guardian angels?"
"Certainly not. Popish superstition, aye."
"Well, I hope I haven't damned you to perdition by making you go to Mass with me. Or do Presbyterians believe in hell?"
"All that we do," he assured her. "As much as heaven, if not more."
It was even foggier here by the river. Roger was glad they hadn't driven. You couldn't see more than 5 feet or so in the thick white murk. They walked arm in arm beside the River Ness, footsteps muffled. Swaddled by the fog, the unseen city around them might not have existed. They had left the other churchgoers behind. They were alone. Roger felt strangely exposed, chilled and vulnerable, stripped of the warmth and assurance he had felt in the church.
"Only nerves," he thought,
and took a firmer grip of Brianna's arm. It was time. He took a deep breath, cool fog filling his chest.
"Brianna."
He had her by the arm, turned to face him before she had stopped walking, so her hair swung heavy through the dim arc from the street lamp overhead. Water droplets gleamed in a fine mist on her skin, glowed like pearls and diamonds in her hair, and through the padding of her jacket he felt in memory her bare skin, cool as fog to his fingers, flesh hot in his hand. Her eyes were wide and dark as a loch, with secrets moving, half-seen, half-sensed, under rippling water. A kelpie, for sure. Iach Ushka. A water horse, mane flowing, skin glowing. And the man who touches such a creature is lost, bound to it forever, taken down and drowned in the loch that gives it home. He felt suddenly afraid, not for himself, but for her. As though something might materialize from that water world to snatch her back, away from him. He grasped her by the hand as if to prevent her. Her fingers were cold and damp, a shock against the warmth of his palm.
"I want you, Brianna," he said softly. "I cannot be seeing it plainer than that. I love you. Will you marry me?"
She didn't say anything,
but her face changed like water when a stone is thrown into it. He could see it plainly as his own reflection in the bleakness of a tarn.
You didn't want me to see that.
The fog had settled in his chest. He was breathing ice, crystal needles piercing heart and lungs.
You didn't want to hear it, did you?
She shook her head, wordless.
Aye. Well.
With an effort, he let go her hand.
That's all right,
he said, surprised at the calmness in his voice.
You'll not be worried about it, eh?
He was turning to walk on when she stopped him, hand on his sleeve. Roger. It was a great effort to turn and face her. He had no wish for empty comfort, no desire to hear a feeble offer to be friends. He didn't think he could bear even to look at her, so crushing was his sense of loss. But he turned, nonetheless. And then she was against him, her hands cold on his ears as she gripped his head and pushed her mouth hard onto his. Not so much a kiss as blind frenzy, awkward with desperation. He gripped her hands and pulled them down, pushing her away.
What in God's name are you playing at?
Anger was better than emptiness, and he shouted at her in the empty street. I'm not playing. You said you wanted me. She gulped air. I want you too. Don't you know that? Didn't I say so in the hall this afternoon?
I thought you did.
He stared at her.
What in hell do you mean?
I mean I want to go to bed with you, she blurted.
But you don't want to marry me.
She shook her head, white as a sheet. Something between sickness and fury stirred in his gut and then erupted.
So you'll not marry me, but you'll fuck me. How can you see such a thing?
Don't use that sort of language to me.
Language? You can suggest such a thing, but I must not say the word. I've never been so offended. Never.
She was trembling, strands of hair sticking to her face with the damp. I didn't mean to insult you. I thought you wanted to...
to...
He grabbed her arms and jerked her toward him.
If all I wanted was to fuck you, I would have had you on your back a dozen times last summer.
Like hell you would. She wrenched loose one arm and slapped him hard across the jaw, surprising him. He grabbed her hand, pulled her toward him, and kissed her, a good deal harder and a good deal longer than he ever had before. She was tall and strong and angry, but he was taller, stronger, and much angrier. She kicked and struggled, and he kissed her until he was good and ready to stop.
"The hell I would," he said, gasping for air as he let her go.
He wiped his mouth and stood back, shaking. There was blood on his hand. She'd bitten him, and he hadn't felt a thing. She was shaking, too. Her face was white, lips pressed so tight together that nothing showed in her face but dark eyes blazing.
"But I didn't," he said, breathing slower. "That wasn't what I wanted. It's not what I want now."
He wiped his bloody hand against his shirt.
"But if you don't care enough to marry me, then I don't care enough to have you in my bed."
"I do care."
"Like hell."
"I care too damn much to marry you, you bastard."
"You what?"
"Because when I marry you, when I marry anybody, it's going to last. Do you hear me? If I make a vow like that, I'll keep it, no matter what it costs me." Tears were running down her face. He groped in his pocket for a handkerchief and gave it to her.
"Blow your nose, wipe your face, and then tell me what the bloody hell you think you're talking about, eh?"
She did as he said, sniffing and brushing back her damp hair with one hand. Her foolish little veil had fallen off. It was hanging by its bobby pin. He plucked it off, crumpling it in his hand. "Your Scottish accent comes out when you get upset," she said, with a feeble attempt at a smile as she handed back the wadded hanky.
"I shouldn't wonder," Roger said in exasperation. "Now, tell me what you mean, and do it plainly, before you drive me all the way to the Gaelic."
"You can speak Gaelic?" She was gradually getting possession of herself.
"I can," he said. "And if you don't want to learn a good many cross expressions right swiftly, talk.
What do you mean by making me such an offer? And you a nice Catholic girl straight out of Mass? I thought you were a virgin.
I am. What does that have to do with it?
Before he could answer this piece of outrageousness, she followed it up with another.
Don't you tell me you haven't had girls. I know you have.
Aye, I have. I didn't want to marry them, and they didn't want to marry me. I didn't love them. They didn't love me. I do love you, damn it.
She leaned against the lamppost, hands behind her, and met his eyes directly.
I think I love you, too.
He didn't realize he had been holding his breath until he let it out.
Ah, you do.
The water had condensed in his hair and icy trickles were running down his neck.
Mm-hmm. Aye, and is the operative word there think, then, or is it love?
She relaxed just a little and swallowed.
Both.
She held up a hand as he started to speak.
I do, I think, but
I can't help thinking what happened to my mother. I don't want that to happen to me.
Your mother?
Simple astonishment was succeeded by a fresh burst of outrage.
What? You're thinking of bloody Jimmy Fraser? You think you cannot be satisfied with a boring historian? You must have a great passion, as she did for him. And you think I'll maybe not measure up?
No!
I'm not thinking of Jamie Fraser. I'm thinking of my father. She shoved her hands deep in the pockets of her jacket and swallowed hard. She'd stopped crying, but there were tears on her lashes, clotting them in spikes.
She meant it when she married him. I could see it in those pictures she gave me. She said, better or worse, richer, poorer, and she meant it. And then she met Jamie Fraser, and she didn't mean it any more.
Her mouth worked silently for a moment, looking for words.
I don't blame her, not really, not after I thought about it. She couldn't help it, and I... When she talked about him, I could see how much she loved him. But don't you see, Roger? She loved my father, too. But then something happened. She didn't expect it, and it wasn't her fault. But it made her break her word.
I won't do that. Not for anything.
She wiped a hand under her nose, and he gave her back the handkerchief silently. She blinked back the tears and looked at him straight.
It's more than a year before we can be together. You can't leave Oxford. I can't leave Boston. Not till I've got my degree.
He wanted to say that he'd resign, that she should quit her schooling, but kept quiet. She was right. Neither of them would be happy with such a solution.
So, what if I say yes now and something happens? What if I met somebody else? Or you did?
Tears welled again, and one ran down her cheek.
I won't take the chance of hurting you. I won't.
But you love me now.
He touched a finger gently to her cheek.
Bree, do you love me?
She took a step forward, and without speaking, reached to undo the fastenings of her coat.
What the hell are you doing?
Blank astonishment was added to the mix of other emotions, succeeded by something else as her long, pale fingers grasped the zip of his jacket and pulled it down. The sudden whiff of cold was obliterated by the warmth of her body, pressed against his from throat to knees. His arms went around her padded back by reflex. She was holding him tight, arms locked round him under his jacket. Her hair smelled cold and sweet, with the last traces of incense trapped in the heavy strands, blending with the fragrance of grass and jasmine flowers. He caught the gleam of a hairpin, bronze metal in the copper loops of her hair. She didn't say a thing, nor did he. He could feel her body through the thin layers of cloth between them, and a jolt of desire shot up the backs of his legs as though he were standing on an electric grid.
He tilted up her chin and set his mouth on hers.
"See that jacket, Merton, and her with a new fur collar coat?"
"Och, and where's she found the money for such a thing wi' her husband out of his work this 6 months past? I tell ye, Jesse, yon woman..." "Ooh!"
The click of French-heeled shoes on the pavement halted, to be succeeded by the sound of a throat being cleared with sufficient resonance to wake the dead. Roger tightened his grip on Brianna and didn't move. She tightened her arms around him in response, and he felt the curve of her mouth under his.
"Ach, no, Chrissy," came a hissed whisper from behind him. "Let them be, aye. Can you not see they're getting engaged?"
"Mm-hmm," came again, but in a lower tone.
"We'll be getting something else and they go on with that much longer." "Still..."
A long sigh, tinged with nostalgia.
"Ach, weel, it's nice to be young, isn't it?"
The twin tap of heels came on, much slower, past them, and faded inaudibly into the fog. He stood for a minute, willing himself to let go of her. But once a man has touched the mane of a water-horse, it's no simple matter to let go. An old Kelpie rhyme ran through his head.
"And sit weel, Janity, and ride weel, Davy, and your first stop will be the bottom of Loch Gavy." "I'll wait," he said, and let her go.
He held her hands and looked into her eyes, now soft and clear as rain pools.
"Hear me, though," he said softly. "I will have you all, or not at all. Let me love her rightly," he had said in wordless prayer. And hadn't he been told often enough by Mrs. Graham, "Be careful what you ask for, laddie, for you just might get it."
He cupped her breast, soft through her jumper.
"It's not only your body that I want, though God knows I want it badly. But I'll have you as my wife, or I will not have you. Your choice."
She reached up and touched him, brushed the hair off his brow with fingers so cold they burned like dry ice. "I understand," she whispered. The wind off the river was cold, and he reached to do up the zip of her jacket. In doing so, his hand brushed his own pocket, and he felt the small package lying there. He'd meant to give it to her over supper.
"Here,"
he said, handing it to her.
"Happy Christmas." "I bought it last summer," he said, watching her cold fingers fumble at the holly-printed paper. "Looks like prescience now, doesn't it?"
She held a silver circle, a bracelet, a flat silver band with words etched round it. He took it from her and slipped it over her hand onto her wrist. She turned it slowly, reading the words.
"Je t'aime, un peu, beaucoup, passionnément, pas de tout."
"I love you, a little, a lot, passionately, not at all." He gave the band a quarter turn once more, completing the circle.
"Je t'aime," he said,
and then, with a twist of fingers, sent it spinning on her wrist. She laid a hand on it, stopping it.
"Moi aussi,"
she said softly, looking not at the band, but at him.
"Joyeuse Noël."
Part 7. On the Mountain. Chapter 19. Half Blessing. September 1767.
Sleeping under the moon and stars in the arms of a naked lover, the two of you cradled by firs and soft leaves, lulled by the gentle murmur of the chestnut trees and the far-off rumble of a waterfall, is terribly romantic.
sleeping under a crude lean-to, squashed into a soggy mass between a large wet husband and an equally large, equally wet nephew, listening to rain thrump on the branches overhead while fending off the advances of an immense and thoroughly saturated dog, is slightly less so.
"Air,"
I said, struggling feebly into a sitting position and brushing Rollo's tail out of my face for the 100th time. "I can't breathe." The smell of confined male animals was overpowering, a sort of musky, rancid smell, garnished with the scent of wet wool and fish. I rolled onto my hands and knees and made my way out, trying not to step on anyone. Jamie grunted in his sleep, compensating for the loss of my body heat by curling himself neatly into a plaid-wrapped ball. Ian and Rollo were inextricably entangled in a mass of fur and cloth, their mingled exhalations forming a faint fog around them in the pre-dawn chill. It was chilly outside, but the air was fresh, so fresh I nearly coughed when I took a good lungful of it. The rain had stopped, but the trees were still dripping, and the air was composed of equal parts water vapour and pure oxygen, spiced with pungent green scents from every plant on the mountainside. I'd been sleeping in Jamie's spare shirt, my buckskins put away in a saddlebag to avoid soaking. I was dappled with goose flesh and shivering by the time I pulled them on, but the stiff leather warmed enough to shape itself to my body within a few minutes. Barefoot and cold-toed, I made my way carefully down to the stream to wash, kettle under my arm. It wasn't yet dawn, and the forest was filled with mist and grey-blue light. Crepuscule, the mysterious half-light that comes at both ends of the day when the small secret things come out to feed. There was an occasional tentative chirp from the canopy overhead, but nothing like the usual raucous chorus. The birds were late in starting today because of the rain. The sky was still lowering, with clouds that ranged from black in the west to a pale slate blue in the dawning east. I felt a small rush of pleasure at the thought that I knew already the normal hour when the birds should sing, and had noticed the difference. Jamie had been right, I thought, when he had suggested that we stay on the mountain instead of returning to Cross Creek. It was the beginning of September. By Meyer's estimation, we would have 2 months of good weather, relatively good weather, I amended, looking up at the clouds, before the cold made shelter imperative. Time enough, maybe, to build a small cabin, to hunt for meat, to supply ourselves for the winter ahead. "It will be gay hard work," Jamie had said. I stood between his knees as he sat perched high on a large rock looking over the valley below. "And some danger to it. We may fail if the snow is early, or if I canna hunt meat enough. I will na do it if you say nay, Sasnach. Would you be afraid?" Afraid was putting it mildly. The thought made the bottom of my stomach drop alarmingly. When I had agreed to settle on the ridge, I had thought we would return to Cross Creek to spend the winter.
We could have gathered both supplies and settlers in a leisurely manner, and returned in the spring, in caravan, to clear land and raise houses communally.
Instead, we would be completely alone, several days' travel from the nearest tiny settlement of Europeans. Alone in a wilderness. Alone through the winter. We had virtually nothing with us in the way of tools or supplies, save a felling axe, a couple of knives, a camp kettle and girdle, and my smaller medicine box. What if something happened? If Ian or Jamie fell ill or was hurt in an accident? If we starved or froze? And while Jamie was sure that our Indian acquaintances had no objection to our intent, I wasn't so sanguine about any others who might happen along. Yes, I bloody well would be afraid. On the other hand, I'd lived long enough to realise that fear wasn't usually fatal, at least not by itself. Add in the odd bear or savage, and I wasn't saying, mind. For the first time, I looked back with some longing at River Run, at hot water and warm beds, and regular food, at order, cleanliness, and safety. I could see well enough why Jamie didn't want to go back,
Living on Jocasta's bounty for several months more would sink him that much further in obligation, make it that much harder to reject.